But the point is that I know how to handle these crises.
We are and always will be the United States of America.
Excuse me, Fox News.
A series of tubes.
I think we look pretty good.
I'll get Osama bin Laden, my friends. I'll get him. I know how to get him.
E pluribus unum. Out of many, one.
If some of those jobs are lost in this, so be it.
Thank you, Wisconsin!
Liberals and conservatives, Democrats and Republicans, moderates of all opinions, welcome to Civil Discourse. My name is Eric Brandt, and with me, as always, is former state senator Peter Baer. How's it going, Peter?
Going great, Eric. How are you doing?
I am doing great, and as always, you guys are listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. We are live every week on blogtalkradio.com at 11 a.m. Central Standard Time. Just go to Blog Talk Radio and do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their link, and then the link for Civil Discourse. We are joined on the line today. As you all know, this is an election year, and Senator Tim Cullen of the Janesville area of the 15th District is retiring at the end of this term. And joining us on the line is one of the candidates who is actually running for that seat, former Assembly Speaker Mike Sheridan. Mr. Sheridan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you coming on. Now, you were a three-term assemblyman, and from 2009 to 2011, you were Speaker of the Assembly. But it's been about 4 years since you served, which is a lifetime politically. So would you like to take just a minute to kind of talk to our listeners and maybe reintroduce yourself and let them know why you're running for Senate?
Sure. Of course, my name is Mike Sheridan. I'm running for the 15th Senate District. I was born and raised in Janesville, Wisconsin, been a lifelong resident here, and looking to run for the 15th Senate District, which covers a pretty wide range, all the way almost to Monroe, Wisconsin, up to Oregon, Wisconsin, over to Whitewater, Wisconsin, and then everything in between. So you've got Beloit, Janesville, Milton, Edgerton, it's Evansville, it's Broadhead, Orfordville, quite an expanse. But the reason I'm running for the state Senate seat, I lost my election 4 years ago by a very close margin, and I was Speaker. There's a lot of different reasons I lost my election, but one of them, the big ones, is I took my eye off the ball and I was running around the state instead of taking care of, going and knocking on those doors in my own district. So I've been spending a lot of time in the district. I've got no distractions this time as far as trying to support other candidates, and just getting out, meeting the constituents and working real hard. And the reason I'm running is I feel like I made a big difference when I was in the legislature. I was an effective leader, as well as when we were in the minority, I was still able to get things done, and am proud of my record. And if I thought others that are in the race could do the things that I can do, I would probably just stand down and let them do that. But I feel like there's just way too many important issues in the state right now to sit on the sidelines. And I want to go back to Madison. I've always had I'm a labor guy, a union guy, but I've always had a very good working relationship with the business community. And I think that's why, even though in difficult times, I was able to get things done in the state legislature. And I've continued my efforts fighting for working people. In the last 4 years, I've been working with the AFL-CIO as their legislative and policy director for a couple years, and then worked for Wisconsin Regional Training Partnership for a couple years, and that was all about retraining workers for the future. So I've been fighting for working people all my life, and I want to return to Madison to continue that fight. And when I say fight, what I mean by that is just somebody to be a voice for the working people in the state, and somebody that also is, I believe, in having strong relationships with a lot of diverse groups so we can get the job done.
Well, Mike, you're articulating a lot of things that I think we have a consensus on here. Eric told me something before the show that I had not recalled or been aware of. It may have been before I came back to Madison, but But Eric indicated that you were elected speaker on a unanimous vote. Was that a correct recitation?
That is correct.
99-0? Okay. I served in the Assembly, as you, I think you know, and then I served in the Senate after that, this was a lifetime ago. But my recollection and my observation in years since is that it's typical when an election for speaker is held, the minority party has votes for their leader, they knowing they aren't going to win, of course, and then the majority party votes for their leader, and that's the speaker. So it's pretty. I can't say it's unprecedented because I haven't researched it, but it certainly is not typical. I know that. Could you? It would tend to suggest that the other side at least perceived you in a somewhat friendly way. To cast their votes for you rather than whoever the Republican leader was at that time. Would you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. I was very honored that happened. And you're right. It's not a normal thing that happens. But over the years, and part of the reason I became speaker after only 4 years, and of course we were in the minority before that, but was because I'm a relationship builder. I always try and look for common ground. There's a business group in Janesville. It's our Chamber of Commerce, but they call themselves Forward Janesville. And what we always agreed on was, we're not going to agree on everything, but there's areas that we can agree. And when we find those areas, we need to work hard. And I think that the Republican Party saw me as somebody that was willing to work across party lines to get things done. And so that was quite an honor. And one of the things that I did right away was I kept Patrick Fuller on as the chief clerk. Now, Patrick was brought on by the Republicans, but Patrick was a military guy, and he was a fair guy, and he was very well respected. And I took some heat from some people in my own party that I kept him on. But to me, it was the right thing to do. So I've always try to, do the next right thing, and I think that people perceive that. And that doesn't mean that I don't make mistakes, don't get me wrong, but for the most part, I always try and, look for the best results and get things done in a difficult situation.
Mike, obviously, to get that unanimous vote shows that there was some unity within the chamber at that point. On the other hand, since you've left, the state's become very hyper divided and hyper partisan. How are you anticipating the culture is going to be when, assuming that you're elected, which I think you have a very strong chance of, what are you anticipating that the culture is going to be like in the Senate? Do you expect that we're going to see that unity again, or are we living in a whole different world at this point?
Well, I think that there's people on both sides of the aisle that truly are there and they want to do the right things. But I think that there's a lot of outside influences. And what I intend to do is in areas and getting into issues that we want to solve problems, what I will do is relationships that I've built in the business community and people that normally support Republicans are the very people that I'll go to, and if I'm having trouble getting something done and it's something that's reasonable and it's the right thing to do, I'll go to the people in the business community and I'll ask them to put pressure on those legislators with an R after their name and say, hey, this is the right thing to do. We helped elect you. We supported you. We got you in this seat, and we need you to get on board because this is the right thing to do. And so that's just one tactic that I will use. The other one is just right from day one, I feel like I can hit the ground running because I know most of the people on the other side of the aisle, and I know what they're like, and I know what their interests are, and I'll try and reach out and try and find that common ground with them.
Yeah, Mike, as a former member, I can say I know there's no way you could have become speaker, particularly with as relatively short amount of service time as you had then, without everything you just said being true. It would be metaphysically impossible to become speaker unless you were the reach across the aisle type of guy that you are. and the relationship builder that you are. Relationship building is critical to get things done in the legislature, as you intimately know. That one of the conundrums, though, and you kind of alluded to it when you spoke of your 2010 race, and I think you were, I mean, you took all the as you described that, you took all the responsibility for it because you were busy helping other members and maybe not paying as much attention to your own district as you should have, and there's probably some truth to that, but also you didn't point the finger at the fact, and so I'll do it for you, that in 2010 was just an abysmal, horrible year in terms of turnout. And I'm sure that no one anticipated that we were going to have as weak of a Democratic turnout in Wisconsin in 2010 as we ended up having. And if you had known that, I'm quite sure you would have probably reconfigured your campaign schedule from what it was to something different. But so be it. That's behind us now. But the fact is, you were Speaker of the State Assembly, and that means that you had to be if not the most adept, certainly one of the most adept people in terms of relationship building. But one thing we notice is that, I've noticed at least, people when you go door to door, as I'm assuming you're doing, folks in the district don't really understand how it works in the Capitol. So one of your most tremendous selling points is something that the typical voter doesn't really understand. So how do you kind of translate that into the sort of language that regular working folks do understand? And, you know, what issues do you emphasize, and how do you get across obviously very special ability you have to do relationship building, which can lead to success ultimately?
Well, just real quick on 2010 was abysmal. I mean, we lost 532 legislators across the country. I'll tell you one of the things, if in hindsight, and it's just so sad because we had some really good legislators, you know, I think of Kristen Dexter and Jeff Smith and great legislators all over the state. And if we would have known, and we were fully funded in our campaigns and felt very good about it. And if we'd have known that the mood of the country was so abysmal, we would have circled the wagons, and because we were putting money into campaigns of candidates that necessarily, I guess what I would say is we would have circled the wagons and protected the people that we had there instead of trying to reach out and get more. But one of the things that I'm doing on the doors now is, really, I just take the time. I mean, it's kind of difficult because I'll get into situations where the other day we were out on the doors and I met a gentleman and he wanted to talk. So I spent a half hour with him. Well, as you know, the 15th Senate District is rather large. I got down the road and there was another gentleman that he was a school teacher and he was really upset with what's going on in Madison and how teachers have been impacted. And people just want to vent. And so you spend a lot of time just allowing them to do it. But one of the neatest things that happened was yesterday I was meeting with a lady, and I said, if you ever need anything, I said, you call me. My phone number's on there if you have any questions. And I always tell people, if you have any ideas or constructive criticism, I don't have all the answers, and you are the people that I want to hear from. Well, she said, well, there is one thing. She said, I have these tomato plants that I need to get into the ground. And so I ended up, I went and got my grandson because he was helping me do some doors, and his buddy, and we planted her tomato plants for her. It was just really kind of one of those neat things that I wanted to teach my grandson. He's 16 years old. I thought it was a good civic duty thing. But anyway, as far as back to the doors, the message is about jobs and the economy. How do we get people back? When I was 18 years old, I had a good family supporting job to go to. I started working at the GM plant the day after I graduated from high school. And so that's the top priority: education, making sure that we're supporting good public education. So those are the two of the main things that I talk about. And then I also, what I like to do is when I'm talking to people is turn it around, and I want to hear from them, and I want to talk. Dale Carnegie taught me that when I took that is let's talk in terms of the other person's interests. So what interests them? And so that's what I talk about when I'm on the doors. And to me, it's about empathy and the people skills and bedside manner and letting people just talk about what they want to talk about.
Mike, we're getting short on time, but I like what you just talked about referring to jobs and education. Can you kind of expand on what your ideas there are? Obviously, Janesville, Beloit, that entire area has been, you know, in really rough shape since GM pulled out. And some people would say the government can only do so much. Others would say that there's a lot you can do. Where do you stand and what are some of your specific ideas?
Well, personally, I think that we have to support our small businesses, their job creators, and we have to support, the businesses of every level because those are the ones. But one of the main things that I think could help this area is I've continued my efforts. Even after I lost my election in 2010, I flew to Detroit and met with General Motors. And I've got a lot of friends within the General Motors organizations as well as UAW. In fact, in the UAW, we've got people that were part of my leadership team that are now working in the highest levels of the international UAW. Dennis Williams, the new president of the UAW International, he was our regional director at the time. And I can tell you that there is efforts behind the scenes to try and bring product back here into Janesville. And that doesn't mean they go into the old plant. They build a new plant. But I always like to emphasize it can't be just about that one thing. But if we could get that GM to come back to Rock County, that would go a long ways to solve a lot of the problems that we have and making sure that our kids have a place to go to work. I mean, there's so many other impact jobs or businesses that are impacted by that. So that's one of my top objectives. I talked to Governor Walker. I ran into him a week ago. And I've also talked to Mary Burke, who I hope is our next governor. But I'll work with anybody. I told Governor Walker, I said, when this election's over, I said, we need to fly to Detroit, and we need to bring General Motors back to Janesville. And I said the same thing to Mary Burke. So I'll work with anybody to bring jobs back in to Wisconsin. But we've got to have a better atmosphere in what Governor Walker did 4 years ago. The first thing he did was great. He said, Wisconsin's open for business, and then he dropped the bomb. And it's created an atmosphere where people are afraid to come to Wisconsin, and people that are here are afraid to expand. We need to change that atmosphere and create stability.
Well, Mike, after hearing the way that you described your door-to-door activities and as well as telling Eric and me just before the start of the show what your day looked like today, the kinds of things you're doing, there's no doubt in my mind that we're going to be welcoming Senator Sheridan to the Capitol in January, and in a fine thing it will be, not only because we happen to agree with you're on most, if not all, the policies you're talking about. But quite frankly, what we need is someone who really gets it in terms of relationship building. That is what is so painfully, conspicuously absent in the Capitol today. And what you are speaking of with full credibility to me, because you couldn't even say those things unless you understood what we know, those who have been out there doing that. So keep it up, and all the best of luck to you. And you won't need a whole lot of luck. We just want to make sure we get a good turnout.
How can people get involved with your campaign, Mike? Do you, what's your website?
Okay, it's Sheridan for Senate, and then you can also go on Facebook. And there, so we have a website as well as Facebook, Sheridan for Senate. And, obviously it's boots on the ground. We need volunteers. Obviously, if people want to donate to our campaign, we have it's Sheridan for Senate, and it's P.O. Box 1711, Janesville, Wisconsin 53545. And before we end here, it's very important to me, to Senator, thank you for your service. And I want to get things back to the way they were when you served in the legislature, and that's what is sorely missed here in this day and age. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. From your lips to God's ears, as we say.
Mike Sheridan, running for the 15th Senate District here in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Sheridan. Have a great weekend.
Hey, and call me anytime. I'm happy to talk to you guys anytime. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
And that was Mike Sheridan, again, former Speaker of the Assembly in Wisconsin, who is now running for Tim Cullen's seat as Senator Cullen is retiring at the end of this term. He does have two primary opponents, Janice Ringhand, and I know I'm going to say this name wrong, so I apologize, sir, Austin Szczesinski. We did reach out to Assemblywoman Representative Ringhand to ask her on the show as well, did not get a response. And I also looked for a way to get in touch with the Republican Brian Fitzgerald. And I'm, to be absolutely honest with you, I'm not 100% sure that this guy is actually convinced that he's running, because I couldn't find a website. His Facebook page was almost nothing. And I found one page where you can go donate, and he was up to a whopping 3 supporters. So I'm not sure.
That would be fairly ominous in terms of his prospects. But I can tell just from my time in politics, and I won't belabor it, but what Mike was talking about, going door to door and the way interacting, planting the tomatoes and things like that. Eric, I got to tell you, I was at a hospital this past week, just picking up some medical records for a client. And the lady at the desk looks at my driver's license, because I had to show my ID to pick up the stuff. And she said, did you ever run for office? I said, yeah, a long time ago, though. She said, my mother wanted to vote for you so badly, but she wasn't in your district. And I said, well, that's very kind of you to say. Please tell her thanks for me. She said, I can't. She died 33 years ago. So when you get down at the door-to-door level with the people, Mike Sheridan described it in a way that no one could ever describe it unless they actually did it. And when you do that, you win.
It looks like we have a phone call. I'm going to try and go here. Let's see if you are on the air on Civil Discourse. Hello? Hello? You are on the air? Nope, they hung up. Okay. You know, one thing that I noticed here that Assemblyman Sheridan was talking about was Forward Janesville. They are very right-wing, very pro-Walker. And if you watch the documentary As Goes Janesville, they're very tight with, Joe Nylons, who beat Mike Sheridan in 2010. And there was two other Republicans who won the assembly seats in that district, actually, in 2010. Tim Cullen, a Democrat, won the Senate district, but all three assembly seats were won by Republicans, which is kind of odd, but that's the way it worked out.
Extremely unusual.
And
it shows you the power of Tim Cullen's name on that ballot.
It really does. And I think that Mike Sheridan's going to bring a lot of that as well. But they were showing some of the things that Forward Janesville was doing, and they were pushing really hard with Diane Hendricks, who is off the wall right wing. And they were talking about how GM is going out, and they can, oh, we could use this space to bring in a factory at, oh, we could, you know, they don't need $14 an hour. They'll be happy to have a job. We can pay them minimum wage. These are the kinds of people that Forward Janesville is representing. Mike Sheridan's ideas are not like that. They are way to the left of that, and yet he's able to find common ground and work with these people.
Exactly.
That shows some integrity
It does, and it shows integrity, and it also shows pragmatism. Let me give you an example that could be still relevant today, even though it was so long ago, because the issues were hot. When I was serving in the Senate, I had a very strong record in terms of women's health issues. Pro-choice was my position, but there was an issue that the Catholic diocese in my district, or one of them, was very interested in, which was textbooks, non-religious textbooks. Nobody was going to suggest that the state have to pay for religious textbooks, but for non-religious textbooks, for standard English history books that were used in public schools, that they be allowed to be provided to parochial schools on the premise that even if that every child in Wisconsin is entitled to an education, and if the child's parents happen to select sending them to a parochial school, that's their choice, but the child shouldn't necessarily be deprived of the same non-religious textbooks just because their parents made that choice for them. So I remember being invited to a diocese event, and the priest who was actually in charge of the event, and there were hundreds of people, a couple hundred people, I would say, said, now we know that a lot of you don't agree with Senator Baer's position on the abortion issue. I'm going to ask you today, but he has been giving us great help on the issue of these textbooks for the schools. Tonight's event is to discuss that bill. I forget the Senate bill number now. It was so long ago, but is to talk about the textbooks, the textbook legislation, which he has been supporting us, and we're very grateful to him. Thank you, Senator, and so on and so forth. So please don't jump all over him about the abortion issue, because he's helping us on this other issue that's very important to us, and we're grateful to him in coming tonight to talk to us about it. So that's what we're here to talk about tonight. So they didn't pound on me about why am I for pro-choice and all that stuff. Well, that's the kind of thing Mike Sheridan, I think, is talking about. You don't have to agree on everything, but you can still talk, and there may be some areas of common ground. And it's that kind of approach that really got me fired up just listening to Mike Sheridan talk about it that way, and learning from you that he had won, and then him confirming the 90-90-0 vote. That is an exceptional event in political history. It doesn't work like that in Washington or in Madison.
And I think that, you know, that kind of talk is, you know, he's going to shore up the Democratic base. I don't have any concern about that. The independents, though, are going to be hearing what he's talking about and what you're referring to, because, frankly, I don't hear that from Republicans. You go back and you look at Joe Nylons when he was running against Sheridan, and it's all negative. It's all partisan. It's I'm not working with these guys. You know, it was nothing about commonality or finding a way to get things done. It was just about partisanship and rallying up the Tea Party. The Democrats have really, you know, there's still enough Democrats occupying the left. I think we could use quite a few more, to be honest with you. But they've also filled in that gap in the center there, which I think is why we've been winning elections. You know, 2010 was an anomaly, but 2006, 2008, 2012. And I think that that's part of the reason, is that people are seeing that the Democrats actually are willing to get things done, and they're not boiling things down to bumper stickers that are just hyper-partisan. They're actually making a point to look at the issues. Case in point, and we're not going to get on the whole Iraq thing, but case in point, when President Obama gave his speech this week about Iraq, he was talking about where Iraq has kind of put our country and opened up all these old wounds. And he said, this goes to show you how important it is for us to ask the tough questions before we do something like this. And those are the kinds of things that the Democrats seem to be doing now, is they're asking those tough questions. And Republicans like to blur those lines, calling them, you know, elitists, and, oh, they're, you know, oh, you want everyone to go to college? Oh, what a snob! You know, those kinds of things. But no, if you can't run a exactly, you can't run a company from the hip, let alone a country or a state. You are listening to Civil Discourse on Janesville Community Radio. My name is Eric Brandt. With me is former State Senator Peter Baer. We're here every Saturday at 11 a.m. Central Standard Time. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click their link, and then the link for Civil Discourse. And if you'd like to call in, we'd love to hear your thoughts. 323-580-5769.
You know, I'd like to mention, Eric, in terms of turnout, which of course was the reason that 2010 turned out as it did for the state of Wisconsin, it was partly due, as Mike Sheridan aptly described, it was partly due to a whole national wave, but it was also due to a really poor turnout of the Democratic base in 2010. And I saw a bumper sticker last week that I hadn't seen before, and it was a quote. It was big enough to be able to read easily for me. And the quote was from Plato, so it goes back quite a ways. And it was this: the price of apathy is to be ruled by evil men.
Exactly. That kind of goes along with, what do they say? It's evil people are not, it's not evil people that cause issues, it's people who do nothing or something like that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just I forget the exact quote, but it's along those same lines.
Plato said it pretty well a couple thousand years ago.
But, you know, moving forward, we're already halfway through the program here. Political bombshell kind of dropped this week for Scott Walker. And before we get into the criminal scheme that Scott Walker is now at the center of, there is an article out there on newrepublic.com, and it's called Scott Walker's Toxic Racial Politics. And I would really encourage anybody that's listening to go out there and read this article. We're just going to kind of discuss it, summarize it, give our own thoughts here, because this was before everything came out on Thursday. And what's being talked about here is how Scott Walker is really the darling of the right wing, and he's in the pocket of the Koch brothers. He's well-funded. A lot of people think that after 2011, when he crushed the unions and he just became this political rock star, that he is kind of the sleeper for the Republicans in 2016. And they're seeing him as someone who can unify the far-right Tea Party with the more moderate business people in the Republican Party. And this article is shooting the entire thing down. It opens up talking about one of the right-wingers on the radio in Milwaukee and some of his racist comments. And if you go there, I think he was talking about Gwen Moore and making some very disgusting comments that we're not going to talk about here. But Walker had no issue appearing on this guy's show constantly. He has been on that show and other right-wing shows in that area for the last 12 years since he was county executive in Milwaukee, to the point where he actually had his own special phone line that he could call in to be sure to get in with these guys. And I think that this kind of goes to show you how Walker has spent his entire time as governor. He's just been parading around the country at that point, parading around the state and the airways. But right now, as governor, he's parading around the country to kiss the feet of various donors, and he's appearing at right-wing rallies like CPAC and anything else in Iowa, things like that. And it's given him name recognition with conservatives all over the country, but he's not been governing the state. When asked recently if his accomplishments had, quote, sunk in, saying that he had gotten the state back on fiscal ground and whatnot, he said no, because he was too busy doing them. Well, that's not true. He's actually had to tone down his out-of-state journeys because the people of Wisconsin are catching on that he's never here, and he doesn't seem to know how to be a governor. He knows how to be a campaigner, and he is continually campaigning for president, and the only reason that he wants to be reelected governor is another stepping stone to the White House, and people are starting to see through this.
Well, the Republicans are so short of viable presidential candidates right now that even Scott Walker is considered to be on the relatively short list, let's say. And he has been doing that, and he should be very wary. Mike Sheridan just pointed out when we had that interview with him earlier, how back in 2010, because he was speaker, he was in leadership. Well, not just in leadership, he was the most powerful legislator, one could argue, Speaker of the Assembly. He took it upon himself to help other Democrats around the state who needed help. He didn't realize that things could go so badly as they did back in the district, and that cost him his seat at the time. I think hopefully we'll have a happy later chapter when he's elected to the state Senate and brings his considerable relationship building skills to the legislature sorely in need of those skills.
Were kind of talking about the Republicans not only having a very short list and Walker.
Right. I guess what Walker, thanks for refreshing my memory there, but what Walker's doing now, he's spending so much time looking at the national picture, hoping that he can be on that, you know, presidential short list, that it's, as Mary Burke steps up her campaign efforts, that makes it more and more obvious that Walker is missing from the state. Where is he? What state is he in? What state is he governor of? He's only governor of one state, but he's not in the state he's governor of.
But he's in Florida. He's in California, Vegas, Iowa, New Hampshire.
New Hampshire. Go figure. How many people in New Hampshire vote in Wisconsin elections None, presumably.
Well, according to them, that's why we need voter ID, obviously,
right,
because
exactly.
all these people
right.
are.
Because, you know, it might very well happen that the whole state of New Hampshire will come in buses, and then they'll try and vote in Wisconsin elections fraudulently.
Shipped in by yeah. unions. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So Walker now needs to come back and spend some time here, but that's a mixed blessing for him at best, considering the questions that now relating to his the John Doe, which he likes to declare dead. But, you know, there's an old saying, but my favorite Arab saying is he dead or is he dead and buried? Talking about the John Doe, he has, Governor Walker has declared it dead multiple times. But I just happened to get to the State Journal today and it seems to be the headline, so it doesn't look dead to me. Let's put it this way. If it's dead, it sure isn't buried.
Exactly. And, you know, Sheridan said something that I thought was important, and you kind of just, I think you might have even been intending to go here. He said that part of the reason he lost in 2010 is because he wasn't knocking on doors in his district. He was going around the state. Eric Cantor, a lot of people are saying, lost his seat because he wasn't knocking on doors in his congressional district. He was going around the country. Scott Walker could very well lose this gubernatorial race because he's not in Wisconsin. He's going around the entire country.
Agreed. I totally agree with you on that. But also, I don't think we should minimize. And I think, you know, one of the things about our show that I think is special is that we try to be cutting edge on some issues. And I think, and we've had a pretty good track record of things that we say that may be provocative end up frequently coming to fruition within not so many weeks after that we say these things here. So if anyone, for those who do listen to us on a fairly regular basis, our listeners would observe that we're reasonably good at being able to project likely outcomes based on what's going on right now in the historical context. And I think that one of the things that we can't, you know, when you talk about Walker, he should be here rather than out of state, campaign against Burke, so he doesn't go down like Cantor or like Speaker Sheridan did in 2010. But there's something else. It's almost like whistling past the graveyard, at least from the Republican point of view. It is now a very real possibility, if not a probability, that Governor Walker will be running for governor. He will be on the ballot as a criminal defendant. It is extremely unlikely that the John Doe that there will be an indictment and that the whole case will be resolved before November. That won't happen. His lawyers can certainly slow things down enough that there will be no disposition of guilt or innocence prior to the election. But there is a significant possibility, again, if not a probability, in my view, that he will be a criminal defendant when people are choosing to vote for him or Burke. And the criminal defendant, that would be if he is indicted based upon this evidence that has already been released, even though a right-wing federal judge shockingly ordered the evidence to be destroyed. He was that judge who is a Koch Brothers fan club, unofficial, of course. This is, I'm not saying literally fan club president, but he might as, figuratively speaking, this federal judge, extremely right wing, did something that I had never heard before. I heard State Senator Lena Taylor on TV, who's an attorney as well, last night on MSNBC, saying she, as an attorney, has never seen this before either, where a judge actually orders the destruction of evidence. Well, what evidence was he attempting to destroyed that the circuit, Seventh Circuit, stepped in and stopped? Well, some of it came out yesterday, and it's on the front page today. And it's a letter, an email, that appears to be an email directly from Scott Walker to Karl Rove, talking about the need for, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing, need for reinforcements and the worthiness of the Republicans of the Republicans in Wisconsin and of his organization in particular, the worthiness of those people to get resources from resources that Karl Rove then had control over. Now, Karl Rove's super PAC's position is much different now than it was then, but at the time, he was one of the big ones, if not the biggest. And that's not allowed under Wisconsin law. So there is a, in my view, there would be a significant chance that the John Doe would end up in an indictment of Governor Walker. It won't be resolved before the election, but I can't think of anybody ever running for governor who would want to be running as a criminal defendant, either state of Wisconsin or the United States of America versus Scott Walker, be going on in the background while there's you're running for re-election. Now, no doubt that the extreme hardcore Walker supporters will feel that this is some kind of persecution, even though the prosecutor's a Republican, by the way, in this case. They'll be saying that it'll actually probably energize some of his base, but they're already energized anyway. They're coming anyhow. But it's sure among independent, it's hard for me to see this helping him among independent voters. Even if we assume that he keeps his whole Republican base and Mary Burke gets the Democratic base, that's an election that will typically be decided by which way the independent voters go. And independent voters aren't going to be turned on by, a felony prosecution for corruption.
Right. And, you know, I really want to boil this down just to make it just stupid simple here. Because Walker's going around, he was just on Fox News, and actually I think I've got the clip here. We can listen to what he had to say, right?
Must we?
Let's see. I think I've got it. Here we go. Here's what Walker had to say.
We got to point out, you were never charged with anything. But at one point, correct, they alleged that you had a central role in a criminal fundraising scheme. Okay, tell us what you did.
Well, don't just take my word for it. Look at the facts. The facts are pretty clear. You've had not one but two judges, a state judge and a federal judge. A state judge, a well-respected court of appeals judge, and a federal judge more recently have both looked at this argument. And in the past, not just recently, remember, this is not new news. It's just newly released yesterday
because right,
documents were open, but no charges, case over.
That's what Walker wants you to think, all right? He's saying two judges have knocked this thing down, case over, it's finished, you know, do not look behind the curtain. Think about this, though, for a second, okay?
Shades of Chris Christie.
Yeah, which is something else. I want to make another point, actually, after this. But just, you know, connect the dots here for 1 second and just follow me. Now, Judge Randa said that they had to stop the investigation and destroy all of the evidence. That went to the circuit court. That they said, no, do not destroy the evidence, but we're still going to figure out if we're going to let this go on or not. Now, Judge Randa is who Walker's talking about, and he's saying the federal judge said that, you know, nothing here, just, you know, keep walking away.
That's Judge Randa, who was described on MSNBC last night as having a frequent flyer benefits to the Koch brothers resort.
Exactly. This guy is in the pocket of the Koch brothers. He's ruling on a case of Scott Walker, who's in the pocket of the Koch brothers. Then what happens? He rules in favor of Scott Walker, says destroy this evidence, and now we find out that that evidence contains a smoking gun email from Scott Walker to Karl Rove. So you've got two guys working for the Koch brothers making a ruling to destroy evidence, which nobody seems to understand. And then when that doesn't get destroyed, we find out that there's evidence pointing to Scott Walker that could ruin him politically and even put him in prison.
I don't want to quibble about semantics, but
how credible is this guy? That's my point.
When you say that nobody... The judge's ruling to destroy evidence that nobody can understand. I don't mean to quibble over semantics, but I understood it perfectly well. I understood it
from a legal perspective.
Right. Well, there's no precedent that I'm aware of. There may be a precedent somewhere, but lawyers I've talked to can't remember any instance of a judge ordering destruction of evidence. That doesn't pass the smell test, first of all. Secondly, as we discussed at the time, Eric, when that ruling was made, I said, I said it on the air, not just off the air. I said that if evidence has been ordered by this judge to be destroyed, which was quickly shut down by the Seventh Circuit, that said he has no authority to do that, which is true. He has no authority to do it, but he tried to do it. So there must be something incriminating in that evidence. Well, lo and behold, one of the first pieces we see is email from Scott Walker to Karl Rove saying, hey, We got a great organization here, but we need reinforcements. We're highly worthy of reinforcements. Again, I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what the email was that was attempted to be that the judge wanted to have destroyed. There was no mystery to me about why he wanted stuff destroyed. He wanted stuff destroyed because if it was that stuff became public, the chances of Scott Walker being indicted and ultimately convicted would be significantly higher than if that stuff was destroyed.
I agree. And this will also kind of take us back to something you said earlier about the Republicans already having a pretty small bench for 2016. Now, think about this for a second. We've got Scott Walker, who could very well be out of the running at this point. I mean, this is going to damage him, if not finish him. All right. We'll see what happens with the polling and whatnot. It's way too early to talk about 2016 in any certainty, but just think about this. Walker is looking at significant legal issues. Chris Christie is looking at significant legal issues. Both of them not very good to look at right now against someone like Hillary Clinton. Jeb Bush is a Bush. Okay, I'm sorry. He's not going to rally the Tea Party. He's not going to get the base, and he is a Bush.
Substantively, frankly, my own personal opinion, substantively, Jeb Bush may be the best quality candidate they would have in terms of actual intellect and being less extreme than the others.
But his name is toxic.
I agree with you completely. It's too much baggage. It's not going
to
happen.
And to pull the right-wing base in, you know, I say that, but then Romney made it through the primary. But then you look at Rand Paul. Well, look at what's going on with Iraq right now. The PNACers, the Project for a New American Century, these are the guys who orchestrated everything starting in 1997. They started pushing this whole Iraq war thing. They wanted global hegemony. They are the industrial war complex, military complex people. Rand Paul's out there saying that we shouldn't be doing anything outside of America, that we should be not going to wars, which, granted, I don't think we should be going to war in a lot of these things, but these guys, these are the major funders. These guys, they're not going to let him win.
How can the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about in his farewell speech to the nation, which turned out to be, if that wasn't prophecy, there's no such thing as prophecy. The military-industrial complex is a critical part of the Republican financial base, let's just say. Critical, major part of the Republican financial base. So Rand Paul, while he may have a lot of appeal to some Republicans, especially on the more libertarian edge of the party, the military-industrial complex would be horrified to have said they'd almost rather have a Democrat. Hillary Clinton would be more likely to utilize their services, such as they are, than would be Rand Paul.
I completely agree with you. And again, you and I think, are the only ones talking about that. I haven't heard that anywhere else, but there's no way that PNAC is going to support Rand Paul. Right. Paul Ryan, you know, a few years ago, he seemed like he was a very viable choice. But after what we saw in 2012, the whole point they put him on the ticket was to rally the Midwest, and he didn't get a single state here. Okay. And not to mention, he's just toxic. So
he didn't even carry his own congressional district.
He didn't even carry his own block. Didn't carry his own neighborhood.
For vice president. He did for Congress.
For Congress.
But vice president? No. We're not going to vote for you.
And then we've got Ted Cruz, who, if you want to try and run him, go for it. But he's not even born in America.
They talk about Obama being born in Kenya, which Obama has provided proof that he was born in Hawaii. This guy admits he was born outside the United States.
He's born in Canada,
We've never had a president.
And his dad wasn't an American, so he can't claim the same thing that Obama did.
Right.
Unless his mom.
Well, no, his mom was American. Yeah, his mom was American, but even so, there's question about the constitutionality, whether he could run. Ted Cruz is such an extremist that I think he would make Barry Goldwater was viewed in the LBJ versus Goldwater election. Cruz would be even worse than Goldwater. He might be limited. He might get a few states besides the five or six deep South states. The Idahos and the Wyomings, you know. But I think you'd be talking about less than a dozen states.
And maybe that's what it's going to take. I don't know who else is on their bench. I mean, that's pretty much the whole thing. And
another one who's smart, frankly, but he just doesn't seem to get any traction, is Huntsman, in my opinion. Former Utah Governor Huntsman, who was ambassador to China
under Obama. Exactly.
Actually is a Republican who, you know, at least if I wouldn't, of course, I'd support Hillary over him. On the other hand, you know, I feel like I could go to bed at night and not worry about some freak pressing the button You know, in the world coming to an end, because Huntsman has his head screwed on.
And I haven't heard any talk of him. And he was out after, like, Iowa, I think. Yeah, he jumped out. He just wasn't too normal.
Too normal, too intelligent.
He was too normal. Yeah. So what is that going to do? Are they going to bring back Santorum? He's going to run. Santorum's going to run. He's already talking about it. Perry's probably going to run. Romney, I'm not convinced.
Oops.
Not convinced that Romney's not going to jump back into this thing. So it's going to be a replay of 2012? Is that what we're going to see?
Yeah, here we go.
We're going to have to see Hillary go against someone like Ted Cruz and absolutely blow them out of the water. 1964, just watch her take 60-some percent, just like Johnson did. And that's what it's going to take for the Republicans to realize that they can't go on like this.
The hideous risk of this thing for the Republicans, hideous for them, but actually joyful for those of us who are on the opposite side, is that if they nominate somebody as extreme as Ted Cruz, which is not out of the question, given the short bench and the fact that that Walker and Christie are facing very, very, very serious legal problems, Cruz isn't out of the picture at all under these circumstances. And the fear is, okay, it's a given. It's virtually a given that, barring some lightning strike, Hillary would squash Ted Cruz. But having someone like him at the head of the ticket is going to probably cause the loss of both House and Senate. Hillary Clinton, if the Republican is not a credible Republican, if you don't get someone at the head of the ticket who can at least, you know, maintain the red states being red, then there's a risk that someone like Cruz could drag the whole ticket down with him, and Hillary could end up with a majority in both houses.
If the Democrats are able to hold on to the Senate this year with even just one or two votes, there's a very strong chance that in 2016 they will have a filibuster-proof majority because, number one, it's a presidential year where they do well, and number two, all of the 2010 Tea Party seats, the Ron Johnsons, Rand Paul. Well, Rand Paul's in Kentucky. He'd probably be all right. But, you know, the Ron Johnsons and a lot of these other people who won seats in states where they probably shouldn't have.
Right.
And if Russ Feingold runs against Johnson and Hillary's on the top of the ticket, it's that seat is as good as flipped already.
Oh, you know?
Agreed. And so with that said, if they are able to
even if it isn't Feingold, as long as it's a credible Democrat, that Johnson's gone.
Yeah, he only has like 37% name recognition at this point.
He doesn't even seem to care, really.
He's in way over his head. Yeah. But to see if Hillary wins, assuming that she runs, which I can't see that she doesn't. Everything just seems to be falling in line. She's going to. Hillary runs. She wins. She pulls the Senate with a filibuster-proof majority. And if you can flip the House by just one seat in a presidential year, which is not impossible, looking at the fact that those districts are now 5 years old, people move, mm-hmm. Okay, people's opinions change, new people are getting into the voting populace, it's not impossible to see that Hillary could actually get to a point where she can actually do something real. The things that Barack Obama said he was going to do, in some cases tried to do, if the population pushes her, she could be the next LBJ or the next FDR and really create a revolution in this country.
Indeed. And I might add, by the way, maybe this we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, but you notice there's a few Democrats who get interviewed a lot lately as, like, they might run for president, but, like, if Hillary doesn't run, because everybody knows if Hillary runs, that's it. She's going to be our nominee.
There's still going to be a primary.
Maybe the guy from Montana. He's a nice guy. Schweitzer seems to be a good guy, but he knows better. If he runs against Hillary, it will be a mild thing, hoping that he could maybe get a vice presidential or something. But who I'm actually looking at more than him, I like Schweitzer a lot. I think maybe he should be a cabinet secretary or something under Hillary. But the person who impresses the heck out of me is Jim Webb from Virginia. A former senator now.
I thought you were going to say Sherrod Brown.
No, I really like Sherrod Brown, too. No problem with Sherrod Brown. If Hillary wants Sherrod Brown as a running mate, I think that's a great choice. But another great choice would be Jim Webb. Jim Webb was the highest-ranking military person to ever serve in the U.S. Senate and served as a Democrat. And I loved something he said in an interview once. An interviewer, a reporter was asking him, said, Senator, when you were a military commander, you had to make life and death decisions in a matter of just seconds sometimes, didn't you? And he turned and he looked at the reporter very firmly and said, sometimes immediately. The reporter wasn't experienced enough in life to know the difference between several seconds and immediate. But Jim Webb knows the difference. I'm okay with him on the ticket.
Yeah. I don't know. I still think that there's going to be a primary. If for nothing else, the Democratic Party is going to have to run a primary against Hillary Clinton just so that she can start debating again. Mm-hmm. You know, get back out
Good
there
point. Good
and
point.
Start paying attention.
Schweitzer might be the perfect guy because he's a friendly guy. People like him. He's from Montana. You don't get a lot of Democrats out of that region.
And I think if Hillary is the only one who runs and she doesn't start, and she is going to the left. She came out for gay marriage. She came out obviously for women's rights, pro-choice. She's come out for marijuana legalization. She's, I think she's got some things on the back burner to pull a rabbit out of the hat, like the student loan, things like that. But if she doesn't take a very left-wing stance for the people, at that point, I think it's almost guaranteed that Bernie Sanders gets in, even if the only reason is to pull the conversation to the left.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And I don't know that Bernie has any kind of a chance. I think he would run as a Democrat. He is actually polling really well. He's been polled as the most popular sitting politician.
Really?
And a lot of people are pushing to get him in there. And I think I would personally support Bernie over Hillary in the primary, but that is neither here nor there because Hillary's polling 50, 60, 70% at this point. So it's going to be interesting to see who she chooses for the bottom of the ticket. A lot of people want to see Elizabeth Warren. Other people are afraid that two women is going to be too much and it's going to alienate men. I don't know. It's sad we even have to bring that up,
it is a reality. And I think that's just the reality. A woman having the first woman president will be a great thing to try and have two women on the ticket. That doesn't mean that we couldn't still win, but chances are it adds an element that is less likely to be helpful. And when Hillary has plenty of good men to choose from within the party for a running mate. It's just a little bit safer strategy, I think.
Yeah, it is. And we'll see. This whole Scott Walker thing, it terrifies me, the thought of him even being considered for president. We didn't get into this article as deeply as I wanted to, but I recommend that everyone go and check this out. Go to www.newrepublic.com, and the article is Scott Walker's Toxic Racial Politics. It's a long article, but it's definitely worth the read. There's a lot of interesting stuff about his past as far as how much of a right-wing religious guy that he is, believing he's chosen by God to be governor and running against abortion. And yeah, Romney tried that whole thing. It didn't work out so well. But unfortunately, that takes us up to the end of the program. You're listening to Civil Discourse. We're here every Saturday at 11 a.m. Central Standard Time on Janesville Community Radio. Just go to blogtalkradio.com, do a search for Janesville Community Radio, click on their link, and then click on the Civil Discourse link, and you can hear us every single week. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, send us an email at civildiscourse2011@hotmail.com. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Facebook. On Twitter, we are @@CDiscourse. On Facebook, just do a search for Civil Discourse. Thanks to Janesville Community Radio for giving us this platform. Thank you to the Rock County Progressives, Democracy Rocks, 350 Madison, and the Oconomowoc Dems. We appreciate the support that we get from all of you. And thank you to Mike Sheridan. Make sure that you guys all get out there and vote in the primary, which is coming up in August. We're about 2 months out, not even a month and a half. So that's going to do it for this week. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Eric. Good show.